1963, Birmingham, Alabama, the Civil Rights Movement. The Birmingham protest was against segregation of the races in public schools. In 2 days, more than 700 people were arrested. In June, Governor George Wallace stands in the doorway at the University of Alabama to prevent Negroes from enrolling. President Kennedy goes on the air.
Following a series of threats and defiant statements, the presence of Alabama National Guardsmen was required on the University of Alabama to carry out the final and unequivocal order of the United States District Court of the Northern District of Alabama. That order called for the admission of two clearly qualified young Alabama residents who happened to have been born Negro. That they were admitted peacefully on the campus is due in good measure to the conduct of the students of the University of Alabama who met their responsibilities in a constructive way.
Throughout 1963, the civil rights movement grew, led by the Reverend Martin Luther King.
We must no longer feel that we can settle for tokenism. For token integration is little more than token democracy.
As the civil rights movement headed toward a crescendo, other voices were heard, warning that the civil rights movement was something more than it seemed. The governor of Mississippi, Ross Barnett.
It is obvious to many of us throughout the country that the racial agitation, strife, and conflict that has been stirred up throughout our nation is largely communist-inspired.
Another man whose voice was raised in opposition to the civil rights movement would continue to be a major spokesman for his followers, even to the point of running for president in 1968. George C. Wallace.
I shall continue to resist for you within the law and in keeping with the traditions of our section of the country. I shall continue our fight with dignity and integrity as we have done in the past. I can tell you that I hope that God will bless all the people of this state, both black and white.
Wallace followers had a chant of their own. The 1963 demonstrations reached a peak in August with a massive march on Washington. Its organizer was civil rights leader A. Philip Randolph.
I pledge my heart and my mind and my body to the achievement of social peace through social justice.
And in that massive rally, Dr. Martin Luther King said, "I have a dream." But it was a dream that throughout the 1960s would remain unfulfilled. In 6.5 years between the March on Washington and the end of the decade, the movement for civil rights for American Negroes took many shapes. There was violence and rioting. There were quietly enacted laws. There was death and defiance, but underlying all was an unfulfilled hope expressed by Dr. King in the words of an old Negro spiritual.
Free at last! Free at last! Thank God Almighty! We are free at last!
Martin Luther King, Eldridge Cleaver, Rap Brown, James Meredith, Roy Wilkins, Whitney Young, names from the ranks of American Negroes, names which came to be known to all Americans. There were other names that burst into the news in the 60s. Some have been almost forgotten in the rush of great events. Remember Joe Valachi?
There was a gun and a knife on the table. I repeated some words he told me, but I only could explain what he meant. You lived by the gun and by the knife, and you died by the gun and by the knife. Well, then he gave me a piece of paper, I suppose, you know, and burn it. And then in your hand you say, this is the way I burn if I expose this organization.
You'd be burned to ashes.
Right.
The organization Valachi was telling Senator John McClellan about was the Cosa Nostra, the Mafia. And because of what he told, Joe Valachi would be spending the rest of the decade of the 60s under tight security in a federal prison, a Mafia price on his head. The Congress investigated itself on several occasions during the 1960s. It looked into the affairs of Senate Secretary Bobby Baker and into those of Harlem Congressman Adam Clayton Powell, whose activities as a congressman were studied by a committee headed by New York Congressman Emanuel Seller.
This committee recommends, 1, Adam Clayton Powell be permitted to take the oath and be seated as a member of the House of Representatives. Two, Adam Clayton Powell, by reason of his gross misconduct, be censured and condemned by the House of Representatives. Three, Adam Clayton Powell, as punishment, pay the clerk of the House, to be disposed of by him according to law, $40,000.
But if the American Congress was having difficulties with its public image, they didn't compare with troubles that beset the British in the swinging 60s, all because of a young woman named Christine Keeler. Christine, it seems, had good friends in both the British government and among the Russians, all to the embarrassment of Prime Minister Harold Macmillan.
I did my best, and even when I have to think it over, in the end of my life, I think I'd rather carry the burden of having made a mistake and been proved wrong than have had it the other way and destroyed a man's life when he was really innocent.
Macmillan resigned because of a lot of troubles, not the least of which was the scandal that involved Christine Keeler, War Minister John Profumo, and a Russian military attaché. The whole affair added to a new reputation for the British, and Americans heard a good deal about swinging England. The 60s were dominated by a new interest in things British by Americans. The Beatles not only changed American music, but made long hair and unconventional clothes the rage for American youth. British style swamped the United States, and with it came an increasing interest by Americans in the British royal family. Americans followed the romance between Princess Margaret and photographer Anthony Armstrong Jones as avidly as did the British. And when Prince Charles was invested as the Prince of Wales, millions of Americans watched it on television.
Elizabeth II, by the grace of God of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and of our other realms and territories, Queen, head of the Commonwealth, defender of the faith, to all lords, spiritual and temporal, and all other our subjects whatsoever, to whom these presents shall come, greeting. Know ye that we have made and created, and by these our letters do make and create our most dear son, Charles Philip Arthur George, Prince of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, Duke of Cornwall and Rothesay, Earl of Carrick, Baron of Renfrew, Lord of the Isles, and Great Steward of Scotland, Prince of Wales.
It is indeed my firm intention to associate myself in word and deed with as much of the life of the principality as possible. And what a principality! It is with a certain sense of pride and emotion that I have received these symbols of office. Here in this magnificent fortress, where no one could fail to be stirred by its atmosphere of time-worn grandeur, nor where I myself could be unaware of the long history of Wales in its determination to remain individual and to guard its own particular heritage.
While most Americans were being charmed by the British, there was at least one American who found the British decidedly inhospitable. Actor George Raft, booted out of Britain as an undesirable person.
I'm not a guy to say, well, I'm going to fight Great Britain, because I'm not that big to fight Great Britain.
Britain's greatest leader in this century died in January 1965, Sir Winston Churchill. And in final tribute to him, one of the great Americans of this century, Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Upon the mighty Thames, a great avenue of history, move at this moment to their final resting place, the mortal remains of Sir Winston Churchill. He was a great maker of history. But his work done, the record closed, we can almost hear him with the poet say, sunset and evening star, and one clear call for me. Twilight and evening bell, and after that the dark. And may there be no sadness of farewell when I embark.
3.5 years later, Ike himself would embark on that last great journey. He was one of a long list of great men who passed away in the decade of the 60s. In 1963, the announcement coming from Vatican Radio.
Pope John the 23rd has died. Praise be Jesus Christ. Laudato Jesus Christus.
Counted in the obituaries of the decade were General Douglas MacArthur, actors Jack Carson, Dick Powell, Charles Lawton and Spencer Tracy, Senator Estes Kefauver, Gracie Allen of Burns and Allen, Alan Ladd, cartoonist Jimmy Hatlow, Prime Ministers Nehru and Shastri of India, and King Paul of Greece. Death came for three American astronauts, Grissom, Chaffee, and White, in their fiery Apollo capsule on its launching pad at Cape Kennedy. Francis Cardinal Spellman, Helen Keller, Ed Wynn, Burt Lahr, Judy Garland, Judy Holliday, and John Nance Garner died in this decade, as did Senator Everett McKinley Dirksen, Ramon Navarro, and how many more? Death came, too, for more than 35,000 young Americans in Vietnam, and on a sun-washed street in Dallas, Texas, for John Fitzgerald Kennedy. John Fitzgerald Kennedy, 35th President of the United States. While he lived, he was the focus of all America's hopes and dreams. And since his death, what we remember most is the Kennedy artistry of language, his eloquence.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man.
We stand today on the edge of a new frontier, the frontier of the 1960s, the frontier of unknown opportunities and perils, the frontier of unfilled hopes and unfilled threats. Woodrow Wilson's new freedom promised our nation a new political and economic framework. Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal promised security and succor to those in need. But the new frontier of which I speak is not a set of promises. It is a set of challenges. It sums up not what I intend to offer to the American people, but what I intend to ask of them.
I speak today, in an hour, of national peril and national opportunity. Before my term has ended, we shall have to test anew whether a nation organized and governed such as ours can endure. The outcome is by no means certain. The answers are by no means clear. All of us together, this administration, this Congress, this nation, must forge those answers.
We meet here in an hour of grief and challenge. Dag Hammarskjöld is dead. But the United Nations lives. His tragedy is deep in our hearts, but the tasks for which he died are at the top of our agenda. A noble servant of peace is gone, but the quest for peace lies before us. The problem is not the death of one man. The problem is the life of this organization. It will either grow to meet the challenges of our age, or it will be gone with the wind, without influence, without force, without respect. Were we to let it die, to enfeeble its vigor, to cripple its powers, we would condemn our future.
2,000 years ago, the proudest boast was, Civis Romanus sum. Today, in the world of freedom, the proudest boast is, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Little more than 100 weeks ago, I assumed the office of the President of the United States. In seeking the help of the Congress and our countrymen, I pledged no easy answers. I pledged and asked only toil and dedication. These the Congress and the people have given in good measure. And today, having witnessed in recent months a heightened respect for our national purpose and power, having seen the courageous calm of a united people in a perilous hour,
and having observed a steady improvement in the opportunities and well-being of our citizens, I can report to you that the state of this old but youthful Union is good.
The Kennedy years were years of crisis, the first in Cuba in 1961, with an ill-fated attempt to overthrow Fidel Castro's communist government by an invasion at the Bay of Pigs. Cuba was always to haunt Kennedy.
On that unhappy island, as in so many other arenas of the contest for freedom, the news has grown worse instead of better. I have emphasized before that this was a struggle of Cuban patriots against a Cuban dictator. While we could not be expected to hide our sympathies, we made it repeatedly clear that the armed forces of this country would not intervene in any way. Any unilateral American intervention in the absence of an external attack upon ourselves or an ally would have been contrary to our traditions and to our international obligations. But let the record show that our restraint is not inexhaustible.
Again, in October 1962, Cuba was the crisis. Soviet missiles concealed on the island brought the United States and the Soviet Union to the brink of nuclear war.
Our unswerving objective, therefore, must be to prevent the use of these missiles against this or any other country, and to secure their withdrawal or elimination from the Western Hemisphere. Our policy has been one of patience and restraint, as befits a peaceful and powerful nation which leads a worldwide alliance. We have been determined not to be diverted from our central concerns by mere irritants and fanatics. But now further action is required, and it is underway, and these actions may only be the beginning. We will not prematurely or unnecessarily risk the course of worldwide nuclear war, in which even the fruits of victory would be ashes in our mouth. But neither will we shrink from that risk at any time it must be faced. Acting, therefore, in the defense of our own security and of the entire Western Hemisphere, and under the authority entrusted to me by the Constitution, as endorsed by the resolution of the Congress, I have directed that the following initial steps be taken immediately. First, to halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, will, if found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back. This quarantine will be extended, if needed, to other types of cargo and carriers. We are not at this time, however, denying the necessities of life, as the Soviets attempted to do in their Berlin blockade of 1948. Second, I have directed the continued and increased close surveillance of Cuba and its military buildup. Should these offensive military preparations continue, thus increasing the threat to the hemisphere, further action will be justified. I have directed the armed forces to prepare for any eventualities.
But against the background of world crises, Americans saw in their president a symbol of style and grace and a man dedicated to the arts.
I see little of more importance to the future of our country and our civilization than full recognition of the place of the artist. If art is to nourish the roots of our culture, society must set the artist free to follow his vision wherever it takes him. We must never forget that art is not a form of propaganda. It is a form of truth. The artist, however faithful to his personal vision of reality, becomes the last champion of the individual mind and sensibility against an intrusive society and an officious state. The great artist is thus a solitary figure. Robert Frost said it, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. I hope that road will not be the less traveled by, and I hope your commitment to the great public interest in the years to come will be worthy of your long inheritance since your beginning.
I do not want it said of us what T.S. Eliot said of others some years ago. These were decent people.
Their only monument, the asphalt road and 1,000 lost golf balls. I think we can do better than that.
But John Kennedy was a political man, and it was on a political journey into Texas, where local Democrats were squabbling, that he was on November 22nd, 1963.
Friends, this is the proudest day in the history of Fort Worth and Tarrant County. And now it is my high honor and great privilege to present to you the greatest Texan of them all, who has reflected more glory and credit upon the Lone Star State, done more good for the Lone Star State, served the nation more admirably than any other Texan in the history of our state, the Vice President of the United States, Lyndon B. Johnson.
Congressman Wright, Mr. President, Senator Yarber, Governor Connally, ladies and gentlemen, it is my high honor and my great privilege to present to the good people of Fort Worth our able, our beloved, our fearless leader of the United States and all the free world, the President of the United States.
Mr. Vice President, Jim Wright, Governor, Senator Yarbrough, Mr. Buck, ladies and gentlemen, there are no faint hearts in Fort Worth, and I appreciate your being here this morning. Mrs. Kennedy is organizing herself. It takes longer. But, of course, she looks better than we do when she does it. But we appreciate your welcome. This city's been a great Western city. The defense of the West, cattle, oil, and all the rest. It has believed in strength in this city, and strength in this state, and strength in this country.
From Fort Worth, Kennedy went to Dallas. And from there, into his place in history.